Lives of the Unconscious.
A podcast on psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Episode 36. What poverty does to us and what it has to do with our history. Poverty has never ceased to haunt our society. For some people, very tangibly, through the daily ordeals of economic hardship. For others, as a looming catastrophic threat. And for still others, as a chapter in their own individual stories. After all, most families can trace their lineage back to poverty, sometimes only a few generations back. Even those living in comfort often have parents or grandparents who can still recall what it's like to be poor. This continues to leave marks on the psyches of present-day generations. Even the social crises of our age often reopen old wounds within families. In this episode, we want to look at the psychological dimensions of poverty. What does that mean for the human psyche, to be poor? How do poverty and social marginalization affect future generations, including those who have managed to climb the social ladder? Why is the fear of social decline so destructive and so often coupled with extremist politics? And how can psychoanalysis help people break free from the cycle of poverty and social exclusion? Poverty is a concrete material reality, and yet it also always involves a psychological dimension. It is not uncommon for poverty to take on a traumatic quality, involving the loss of security and control over one's life. This means no longer having a say in personal matters, ending up in powerless situations. It means being objectified and being dependent on the decisions of others. Poverty often means suffering through a wide range of humiliating situations. People do not need much to live a contented life, but they do still need a sense of social inclusion, recognition, and dignity. At its core, poverty frequently entails a deep feeling of shame, even if prejudice is rarely expressed openly. If the supposed concern for the poor is couched in populist rhetoric, even then, the psychology of a capitalist society is to some extent always rooted in social indifference. Our day-to-day lives are permeated by social stratification, even if we are not always aware of it. Who gives whom orders at work? Who can keep others waiting? Who can get away with using first names? Who must use sir and ma'am? Who cleans the house and cuts the lawn? Who has a beach house? Who lives in a high-rise apartment on the outskirts of town? Above all, poverty means less time for living one's life. Everything has to be planned, every expense weighed and budgeted, every new purchase a strain on already limited resources. And for all the work, for all the effort, there is still too little time for the things that really matter in life. Unlike living on a shoestring in adolescence or as a college student, poverty always means the end to a person's future prospects. Just managing everyday tasks saps the energy that would be needed to embark on something new. There is simply no time, not for oneself, not for anyone else, not even for one's own children, who will need exactly that if they are going to escape the clutches of poverty. In a society based on competition, every one of us unconsciously fears becoming poor, fears being among those who lose out and are left out, who are ignored and passed over without a second thought. Society projects its fears of poverty onto those who live in it, offering psychological reasons to explain the poverty of those at the bottom. This means that poverty often appears to be a kind of self-inflicted weakness, the result of laziness, incompetence, lack of talent. It serves to alleviate one's own fears. If I work hard, I won't become poor. At the same time, it is a kind of disavowal, a way of ignoring the extent to which social status is determined by chance, not least by the circumstances of one's birth, or the simple good fortune of being spared bad luck. What's more, such fears also give us a clue as to just how powerless even those in the middle class actually are, how vulnerable we are to circumstances beyond our control, with only limited means to protect ourselves from social crises, and with little control over our own lives. In such a society, it is often consumerism, the possession of commodities or status symbols, that is used to guarantee one's status as a person on top and not down below, even if, for most people, this is nothing more than an illusion. While poverty may be regarded by the wealthy as something of a distant abyss, at once frightening and fascinating, for middle-class families, it is often an unsettling reminder of where they come from, a threatening immediacy that can cause them to distance themselves from poverty all the more aggressively. In no way can they identify with the poor, because unconsciously they fear this is exactly who they are. Especially at times of existential crisis, the middle class has a tragic tendency to abandon solidarity, because solidarity is based on the recognition that we are not so different after all. Very often, negative associations and aversions are unconsciously embedded in the sensations of the body, like in feelings of disgust, often coupled with stereotypes. From the underarm odor of those who work with their hands, to families living off fast food and frozen meals, the images and fantasies we associate with the underclass carry all sorts of negative connotations: darkness, crowds, noise, and aggression. The undifferentiated masses, as if a life in precarious conditions were akin to a mob of rabid beasts. The poor are surrounded by such images day in and day out. All they have to do is switch on the television. It is almost impossible for the poor not to internalize these messages, not to have them resonate in some corner of one's soul, not to feel to some degree that something is wrong with them. Shame and unconscious self-contempt can eat away at the self like a wound, taking an axe to the very psychological qualities that would be needed to free oneself: a sense of self-worth, confidence in one's own abilities, trust in oneself, but also trust in others. It is not uncommon for those living in poverty to withdraw in resignation, sometimes as a kind of passive resistance, just doing nothing, refusing to take part in anything, including, fatally, the political process, as if it were possible for a change to starve the hand that feeds, the institutions, the politicians. Added to this is the not unjustified feeling that politics, public debate, and the media have no bearing on the reality of one's own life. After all, poverty sets fire to deeply buried rage, which is ultimately powerless because the people it affects are without the means to effect change. Those who participate politically are those who feel that they can make a difference and have the time to do so. Those who feel helplessly excluded are often more likely to disengage, sometimes venting their frustration and aggression on their families, unleashing it on those who are even more vulnerable. In this way, the psychological trap of poverty snaps shut, with this feeling of powerlessness, of not having the strength to do more than just get through the day, the window of opportunity in which something could be done about one's situation closes. Sometimes, resignation can also be a kind of last bastion of personal dignity. No more striving, no more hoping, no more dreaming. I no longer believe in anyone, so no one can disappoint or betray me. All the way to extreme forms of complete resignation. No longer working, no longer responsive to anything. Completely passive. In other words, a state of depression. And here, the power to believe in oneself also vanishes, depleting not only the physical, but also the psychological resources that would be necessary to find a way out. Or the exact opposite is wagered. The fantasy of the big shot, of climbing from the bottom to the top. Sometimes, it is even a life of crime that holds the promise of upward mobility, to become someone by not playing by everybody's rules. Someone who rips off others as he pleases. someone who is able to create a world according to their own laws. The lyrics of rap songs can shed light on such fantasies, even if, for the vast majority, they remain a helpless illusion, an empty attempt to dream big. In our society, people can be affected by poverty in very different ways. Although the term may have fallen out of favor, we still live in a class society. Different groups are separated by barriers that are difficult to cross, some visible, some invisible, and some also psychological. Like in the following example, a young woman enters university after excelling in high school. While the others in her high school came from very different social backgrounds, she now seems to be the only one whose parents are blue-collar workers. It is not that she grew up in a situation of extreme poverty, but her parents did have to count every penny, and many of the things that are normal for a middle-class family were not available to her, whereas other things that are unknown to a middle-class family were quite normal for her. Clipping coupons for groceries, turning off the heat to save money, being alone for long stretches of time because both parents had full-time jobs and long commutes, spending summer vacations at the nearest public pool because traveling was too expensive. The young woman is the first in her family to attend university, and there she is confronted with a completely different social reality. In fact, it is only through this contrast that she begins to make sense of her own social upbringing. If all you've ever known is summers at the city pool, then having friends who fly to Bora Bora for vacation is something else entirely. When faced with such striking differences, it is not surprising to feel the need to compare, even if this means seeing one's own family as inferior and devalued, a feeling that can be very difficult to deal with psychologically. It seems to her that the others have something in common that she lacks. Something in the way they behave suggests they already know each other, that they share a set of assumptions and experiences, a code inherited long before the first day of university. Indeed, it is something we all learn from an early age. How we learn to adapt to the particular social milieu we grew up in becomes a part of us. While the others may have grown up in a house, she grew up in an apartment. While the others may have been driven to school in the morning, she had to take the bus. While the others may have gotten help from their parents with their homework or their piano lessons, her high school didn't even offer such things. And her parents wouldn't even have been able to offer much in the way of help. Though she may not be aware of it, the many invisible barriers that she faces on a daily basis are actually indicators of class. As scholars have shown, this isn't only about a family's financial resources, but also about all the intricacies of everyday life that indicate a person's background. There is a term for this code, habitus. It includes the way one dresses, acts, and speaks, whether one uses formal language or dialect, as well as the vast range of accumulated knowledge and education and one's network of friendships and social contacts. All of this translates into a degree of self-confidence that manifests itself in the ordinary details of everyday life. The confidence of knowing who you are, the knowledge that you are somebody, or in our example of the young college student, a sense of uncertainty. Even if she is very gifted, there will still be many obstacles in the way of her future development, and these can have a major impact on how she develops as an individual. She is likely to be confronted with a profound sense of insecurity, the feeling that she is different, that she lacks what others have, and this invariably means questioning her own identity. Perhaps she is able to carve out an area where she feels safe, where she feels confident about her skills, such as good grades. However, the more foreign and unfamiliar something is, the more difficult it may be for her to keep up. How do you talk to professors? How do you conduct yourself in a seminar? How do you write a dissertation? How do you approach a professor when you want to complain about a bad grade? For all of this, she has no role model or support from home, because her parents don't know either, or because she doesn't have any older siblings who might have been through this before. The feeling of being different can be so shameful that she doesn't ask for help, doesn't look for help elsewhere, for example, from the other students. Instead, she keeps quiet, trying to hide her uncertainty. Better not to raise her hand for fear of standing out, even though she's sure to know the answer. Better to leave a question blank than to write something that might be embarrassing. Better not to invite someone over to her family's house out of embarrassment at the way they live. Better to get off the subway a few stops early so that others don't see where she lives. Declining an invitation to a fancy restaurant so people won't know she can only afford an appetizer. Or always getting into conflicts with her parents every time she needs something. Always having to fight for everything. Each and every desire seems to cause her parents embarrassment and shame, perhaps to the point of anger. Why does she suddenly need such expensive things? The young woman can feel the social pressure. She will need a lot of self-confidence to cope with the feeling of being alone, with her thrift store clothes and her summer vacation at the city pool, self-confidence that is still developing, and under especially difficult conditions. It is not uncommon for people in such situations to become very reserved or shy, or conversely, to become hyperactive, to be the class clown, even aggressive. In other words, two different ways of trying to maintain one's self-esteem, one defensive, the other offensive. To others, however, it may appear that something is amiss, that she is different, with all the negative implications that implies. The role of early education is crucial for overcoming such barriers. As early as daycare and kindergarten, latest with the start of school, a teacher is faced not only with a class of students, but also with a society of classes, sometimes more, sometimes less visible. And of course, this also includes the teacher and his or her own individual viewpoint. It is crucial that teachers and institutions are aware of the social dimensions of so-called behavioral problems. Are a child's poor grades a reflection of his or her lack of intelligence? Do they really belong here? Is the child troubled? Maybe they don't know how to behave, haven't been brought up properly. Are the parents ignorant and just don't care? Such attributions very often reflect unconscious judgments and prejudices about the lower class. Perhaps back in school, the young woman in our example had the good fortune of having a teacher who didn't unconsciously instill in his or her students the feeling that they couldn't be intellectuals, that their opinions don't matter, that they don't have what it takes. If, on the other hand, the girl's teachers had turned their backs on her, unconvinced of her abilities, she may have become even more insecure, made even more foolish mistakes that seemed to confirm these prejudices, and would never have made it this far. When it comes to understanding social groups and the role of social marginalization, psychology still has many blind spots. On this issue, research on human intelligence has a particularly unsavory legacy, including outright social Darwinism and racism from big names in the field like Raymond Cattell, and yet it is rarely reflected upon. Historically, when people have been divided into stupid and smart, it has often been along class lines. For the most part, intelligence has been understood to refer primarily to the skills that ensure success in the Western academic middle class, which professors have likewise used as a benchmark for human intelligence. The fact is that every human being is born with curiosity, a desire to learn, and a determination to progress. To borrow an image from the sociologist Theodore W. Adorno, every child is like a snail, sending its feelers out into the world to discover it. If its probing is not reciprocated, if it is left to grope in the void or is even harmed, then the determination to develop and the desire to learn will wither away. It will withdraw its senses from the world, and eventually it will no longer venture out at all. A story of arrested development, of an educational background that has been stunted, is often a story of wounds. Children who persevere and manage to break through such social constraints require unusually strong willpower, as well as the good fortune of good friendships and mentors. The experience of solidarity and being understood strengthens the self and alleviates some of the loneliness that they may feel along the journey. And even if they are successful later in life, it is not uncommon for these childhood wounds to still be buried inside, perhaps as resentment or rigidity, an injury, as it were, that they have inflicted on themselves through clenched teeth just in order to carry on. Even later in life, when the circumstances of one's life are very different, the same inner state can persist, the need to prove oneself, unable to ease up, unable to forgive oneself in the slightest, the need to constantly prove oneself again and again through hard work and success, all the while haunted by the feeling of being a failure as soon as one doesn't succeed, or being particularly hard on those who have not been as successful, often reserving a degree of harshness and severity for one's own children, or a particular insecurity in social situations, the inability to find the words to complain or contradict authority, a sudden feeling of inferiority when others project confidence, feeling less confident in conversations involving intellectual topics. These types of things can last a lifetime and are often passed on to the next generation. Last but not least, perhaps also a deep, incomprehensible sense of sorrow that becomes a constant feature of one's life. Often there is an unconscious identification with the role of the outsider, the underdog, which becomes particularly pronounced in situations in which an individual's aspirations are on the line. Opportunities are squandered, chances slip by, sometimes through what feel like outrageously foolish mistakes or carelessness, arriving too late for a promising job interview, not responding to a job offer, literally or figuratively missing the boat, or by making choices at crucial moments in one's life that undermine one's own progress, almost as if under a curse, getting pregnant at the very moment one needs time to finish school, dropping out of college to learn a trade, not applying for a position that has just become available, letting others move up the ladder instead of trying oneself, finding a partner who limits one's own potential and drains one's energy. Behind what is referred to in psychoanalysis as fate neuroses or repetition compulsion often lurks the uncanny magnetism of one's own social class. It is immensely difficult to really leave behind the unconscious attachment to the role models of one's childhood, to break through the barriers, not least because social advancement means breaking free of one's social orbit. And with this comes a high emotional price, as we will hear in a moment. Most industrialized capitalist societies offer the promise of upward mobility. Even if today it is nothing more than an empty promise, it often has some foundation in historical truth. The German Wirtschaftswunder after World War II, the large waves of immigration to the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century, or the boom years of the Chinese economy, for example. Although often at great cost to their families, the children of the working class and the lower middle class were able to rise through the ranks. But this also meant that entire generations left their social milieus behind. Stories of upward mobility that are still very much alive in many families. Tales of upward mobility are stories of success, the overcoming of poverty, and the attainment of social status. But what is also often overlooked are the corresponding stories of hurt and humiliation, and ultimately the stories of loss. To ascend means to distance oneself from one's parents, to no longer speak the language of one's family and origin, to no longer be understood by one's own family, sometimes also causing mistrust and opposition within one's own community. It means entering a world where one is not quite at home and leaving behind a world that has become foreign. As we heard in the episode on the Oedipus complex, surpassing one's parents, outdoing them socially, is indeed one of the trickiest phases of psychological development. The world from which one comes, the people with whom one grew up with and whom one loves, begin to feel further and more distant. Feelings of homelessness, uprootedness, not belonging, alienation, and uncertainty can be the emotional traces of just this sort of history. Such experiences of social advancement can be a source of strength. The knowledge that one can succeed despite considerable obstacles can foster a form of self-confidence, often very much based on individual achievements. And yet, for each one of these success stories, there is a story of social instability that spans multiple generations. The feeling of not being an established member of the social milieu in which one lives. As a result, there can be a tendency to assimilate and become subordinate, to cling to fashions, opinions, and authorities that instill a sense of security, to do as others do, for fear of somehow standing out, of being identified as an outsider who doesn't really belong. With this comes a sense of insecurity, a lack of courage to explore one's own ideas, thoughts, and creativity, and perhaps, not least, a deep-seated anxiety among the middle class of losing what so many generations of hard work and suffering have achieved. When crises threaten a person's existence, this anxiety can suddenly turn into panic and can lead to a reactionary panic of catastrophic potential, especially when these fears of social decline are projected onto scapegoats. When instead of trying to understand, one seeks only to purge these negative affects. As studies have shown, it is now the norm in our society that class lines are rarely crossed. The door to social mobility has closed in recent decades. The hurdles are now even higher. And a person's ethnic background is often a major factor apart from social class. Our story of a young woman from a working-class family attending university may be unusual. A person born into precarious circumstances, whose parents are chronically unemployed, and who still manages to get a college degree, is in many places an extraordinary exception to the rule. In most cases, the gap between social classes is too wide, the divisions too deep, and begin early in childhood, long before the beginning of school. What can be done to free oneself from the psychological cycle of poverty? How to cope with the constant threat of social decline and poverty? What kind of contribution can psychoanalytic perspectives offer here? We have formulated 4 points, bearing in mind that in precarious conditions, there are many obstacles that are beyond our control. Number 1, recognize and question the ways in which you unconsciously invalidate yourself. How do I discriminate against myself? Do I think of myself as inferior, not smart enough, inadequate? One of the pernicious features of our society is that those who are excluded from certain opportunities by social structures often blame themselves. I'm probably too stupid to go to university. I'm probably not talented enough to succeed. Often this comes in the form of a deeply felt belief. I'm not worthy of good things. I haven't really earned them. I am ashamed of who I am. When people are surrounded by prejudice since childhood, they begin to internalize it, to see it as part of themselves, to discriminate against themselves in this way. And that means mistreating themselves, not standing up for themselves, sometimes even behaving in ways that support the stereotype, inept, ignorant, undisciplined, at the very moments when it really matters. Recognizing these unconscious identifications in oneself and rejecting them is an important step. This is not me. I'm something else. I'm allowed to wish for something else. This is not about rejecting responsibility for one's own life by saying that society is to blame. Rather, the question is, where is society in me? Am I shaping myself into what others see? And of course, this is not a solution to poverty, but it can give rise to a kind of inner revolt, a productive anger, a renunciation of the role one has previously assumed. Such mechanisms can be deeply ingrained and may persist even after one has risen out of the circumstances that created them. And here, too, it is worth looking at unconscious identifications. How do I actually feel in social situations? For example, when talking to those who seem to have a higher social status or better education. Do I belittle myself? Adopt a submissive position because I actually think that the other person is better? Are there situations in which I am suddenly unable to use the skills, knowledge, and experience that I have? In such situations, I may be comparing myself, involuntarily making myself into someone who doesn't know. someone who is not competent, when in fact it isn't true at all? And finally, in what ways do I invalidate my own background? Do I denigrate what I was given at home because it doesn't conform to the ideals of the academic middle class? Do I endow my own personal history with the value it deserves? Number 2. Don't believe everything others say. Question authority. In what way do I give others power over me, or yield to their judgments and opinions, when I really don't agree? For example, is the teacher really right when they say that my child is not good enough to go to university? Is it really true when someone in authority says, it's not possible, or that's not my responsibility? When believing in oneself is not easy, it is often also hard to speak out, to not let others walk all over you, to question what supposed authorities say. Systems appear powerful and opaque, especially when we don't understand how they work. Government agencies, schools, universities. Some people never get past the front door, not because there is no way in or because they are unqualified, but because their entrance is denied by someone who appears all-powerful, when they say, it's possible, but not for you. In an unfamiliar environment, it can be difficult to trust one's own ideas and thoughts, especially when this means overcoming a difference in perspective. Everything that is one's own is quickly assumed to be wrong, simply because it is different. Am I really stupid because I don't talk like an academic? Or because my way of seeing the world and dealing with problems is different from others? Is it that I lack talent? Or is it rather that teachers, professors, and authorities are unwilling to really engage with what I say, to put themselves in the shoes of someone who is different, who has a different perspective on the world? Daring to try, not being discouraged, even when others appear to be better, is perhaps the key to not living life on the sidelines, not waiting a lifetime for things to work out on their own. Having courage is always the key to freeing oneself from conditions of oppression. Number 3. Find role models you can trust. Especially when it is difficult to believe in yourself, it can be very helpful to seek out those who have overcome prejudices and who you feel understand you. Good role models are people who can show you how to achieve your goals, even when others don't believe in you. Good role models do not feed the envy that usually comes from seeing someone else have something you so desperately want. Instead, they strengthen the belief that you can achieve it yourself. Unfortunately, there can be a tendency to choose the wrong role models. For example, people who appear grandiose, who do great things, but who don't make you feel like you can achieve something yourself, who command admiration, who may inspire the imagination, I'd like to be like that one day, but who don't inspire any ideas of how to go about it yourself. If that person makes you feel even smaller and more insignificant, then you may be dealing with the wrong role model. If, on the other hand, they make you want to create something of your own, or give you the courage to take a risk, then you may be on the right track. Number 4. Get involved. Show solidarity. The demoralization of those who are seen as failures is part of the psychology of neoliberal society. They are taught not to rebel, placated with bread and circuses, or pitted against each other. Or, to speak with a metaphor, parental rule remains unchallenged as long as the children jealously rat each other out. But if the children join forces, aware that they are brothers and sisters, they can overturn what seems to be the most unalterable of circumstances. Those who show solidarity with others who may be in a similar or worse situation will discover one of the most important ways to build confidence in themselves, that they have something to offer others. Those who join with others come to see that they are not alone. And whenever people act together, they create the thing we call power. Power is not a magical substance that only some individuals possess. It is the result of cooperative efforts, where the possibility of changing society always lies. This podcast is written and produced by Cecile Lutz and Jakob Müller. Translated and read by Solomon Lawrence.